Hello and a very warm welcome to our podcast, The Sound of Economics of Bruegel. My name is Guntram Wolf and I'm the director of Bruegel, and I am very pleased today to be joined by Miku Huatari, who is the director of MERICS, the MacArthur Institute for China Studies, based in Berlin. Hi, Miku.
Hi, Guntram. Good afternoon.
Thanks so much for joining us today. We do want to spend some time today to discuss with you, as an expert on China, the EU-China investment deal that was agreed right before the end of last year, and that is now controversially discussed in the European Parliament in various fora, where views on this deal are really very polarized. I mean, there are some people that think this deal is a big mistake because it gives something to China without much in exchange, and it's geopolitically the wrong thing to do. There's others that I think emphasize much more the economic benefits for European companies, the guarantees that European companies receive because they are in China. So with you, I want to really take a minute and perhaps disentangle these various discussions and perhaps start really from a discussion about, you know, what is the core achievement that this deal is all about? Why has the European Commission agreed to it? Why has the EU, at least at the government level, agreed to it? And then we want to zoom in on perhaps the more controversial issues later on. But Miku, you have also recently been writing a little testimony on this deal. Perhaps you can start, walk us through the testimony. And of course, I cannot resist also saying you had problems presenting that testimony because of a recent sanction decision of the Chinese government against MERICS, which I personally thought was very unfortunate because we as think tankers, as academics, we play an important role in, I think, really understanding each other and bridging differences and really being messengers and understanders of policy differences and really trying to understand things rather than complicate things and contribute to mutual understanding. So I thought that decision was quite an unfortunate one, but we don't want to discuss that decision. Of course, you're free to say what you want to say about that one as well, but really focus on the CHAI, and, you know, what are your key messages on CHAI? Miku, please.
Thanks, Guntram, and thanks for the invitation, also for your kind words and the support of you and other directors that our institute has received. I actually really would want to talk about substance because I think the task at hand is to do better work on China and to do that jointly as much as possible. And more research will be required. I think our institute's work has become more important and not less with that development. Look, on the CHAI, or CAI as we say, or Comprehensive Agreement on Investment, I think first of all we have to recognize it is the EU's most important attempt to rebalance the EU-China economic relationship. So in that sense, in itself, it is quite a major effort. It has taken a lot of resources in DD trade. It has taken a lot of political support and machinations to get it to that state where we are at the moment. So let's recognize that because it's, you know, it's also people's time that has been invested in that agreement. In terms of the actual positives, outcomes of that, and why is this a deal that you can support from a certain perspective? I think it's quite clear that maybe the EU has not gotten what it has hoped for at the beginning of the negotiations. But the provisions in the agreement and also the market access schedules that we now have on paper, they hint at quite relevant, but to some extent limited, but economic benefits. And they are related to market access promises. It promises the agreement to codify and lock in opening processes that have already begun. And with that, it improves on a difficult status quo for European companies in China. And, you know, some of these have been promised as a function of the Chinese foreign investment law. Some of them are a result of US pressure. And China is not moving away from its negative list approach. But still, it is a codification, a lock-in, a floor under certain opening processes. And let's also face it, some special treatment for some EU interests, including in the automotive sector and others. The second, I think, major benefit from that is the first step. I mean, you could phrase it even more cautiously, the foundations for bridges into an imagined future of fairer competition in China's marketplace. So it is an initial step to get towards SOE disciplines and subsidy transparency. And that's extremely important. So level playing field, the fact that SOEs might be more unconstrained and operate on the basis of commercial considerations, all of these issues, they do matter. But in practice, I mean, everyone recognizes doing business in China will be far away from a landscape of competitive neutrality. It will by no means approximate reciprocity, another buzzword and concept that we've been striving for. But the fact that there will be more transparency, more SOE disciplines, is an important step forward. Now, these opportunities need to be recognized, but I'm also happy to talk about the downsides of these agreements, I think.
Right. So I think it's great that we start with the opportunities. So you mentioned market access, some discipline on SOEs, greater transparency, and all of that in a binding contract. And I think, as you say, some of those things have already been provided with the foreign investment law that China unilaterally implements. However, those are perhaps more difficult to enforce than when they are codified in an international treaty. So I just want to push, and can I perhaps also advertise here a paper by two of my colleagues, Uri Dadush and André Sapir, both of whom are senior fellows at Bruegel, and they have analyzed this treaty in some detail. And what they suggest is that, in fact, it's quite an achievement to lock in these benefits in a treaty where there is a state-to-state dispute settlement. That means you have at least some leverage on enforcing these issues. So can you say, perhaps before we move sort of on the negative side, can you say a few things about enforcement? I mean, how do you see this in practice going forward? If you are a company that has invested in China and you feel unfairly treated, how do you get the enforcement of your rights under this comprehensive agreement?
This is a critical point, Guntram. First of all, we have to recognize that investment protection, that can, has been kicked down the road. As you know, and colleagues know much better than I, for investment protection, companies will have to rely on the bilateral investment treaties of member states to a large extent. With regard to some of the specific conditions here that we now have in that new treaty, or might have, transparency for subsidies with regard to services, for instance, they can only be enforced, as you've said, through state-to-state dispute settlement. So that's, to some extent, an achievement. But it's also quite unrealistic, I think, that this will develop a bite, really, on the core issues that we face with regard to that development in China. And also proving harm, for instance, in manufacturing, this will still remain in the realm of pretty underdeveloped WTO means, in my understanding at least. So I think, as I said earlier, foundations for bridges into an imagined future of fairer competition, and that's important, but we still have to walk on these bridges going forward.
Indeed. So it's still a long way to really have fair competition, but it's a step in the right direction. Now, what about the negatives, Miko, of this agreement? I mean, there's, of course, a whole discussion about human rights. There is a discussion about the enforcement side and how far we have gone. There is, a much bigger discussion about, what is the geopolitical signal. And perhaps last but not least, there is a discussion about the rights that China gets in Europe, because it's not only China that binds itself vis-a-vis the EU, it's also the EU that binds itself vis-a-vis China. And that might actually mean that it may become more difficult for the EU to implement some of the things it would like to implement, such as the white paper on competition policy and state aid control towards third countries. So perhaps we can start with this last point, Miko, and say a few words about exactly this issue of how do you see the restrictions that this imposes on EU companies and EU policymakers? How much does the EU buy their own hands?
Look, I think that depends on decisions that still need to be taken. My understanding is that in some ways, the negotiation of that agreement has blocked the European Union, at least some key member states and governments, to take a few important steps, including agreeing on the IPI, the International Procurement Instrument, for instance, to push them forward as autonomous instruments with regard to the issue of reciprocity in procurement, because there was also no interest to damage the ongoing negotiations. That might be a tactical consideration, which is appropriate, But I think the core issue now is indeed that set of wider autonomous instruments that is in the making. You might like the specific tools or not, but the general principle of actually looking at subsidies, looking at unfair competition in procurement, looking at supply chain scrutiny, and also the human rights questions. If the EU pulls off developing their own tools, in addition to CAI, I think the overarching balance might end up quite right, at least from my perspective. But this is not a given, and we still have to see where this is going. On the specifics, I think the enforcement that you mentioned earlier, obviously, I mean, in comparison to other EU treaties, I don't think that CAI is a bad state of affairs that you can achieve with international partners. So a fair assessment clearly is, yeah, maybe companies and also governments are not satisfied with the enforcement mechanisms, but at the same time, that's just how it is if the European Union negotiates trade agreements and investment agreements. I think that's a fair assessment.
So, Mikko, let's talk a minute about the geopolitics and perhaps also the human rights issues in some detail. The human rights issues have become one of the key sticking points, and the European Union has imposed some sanctions on four individuals, Chinese officials, that the EU thinks are involved in the camps of the Uyghurs. But of course, there was then counter sanctions. So all of this looks quite ugly and looks as if perhaps both sides won't be ready anytime soon to sign and finalize this agreement. What is your state of assessment on the sort of this human rights issues and the likelihood that this deal will go through?
So my personal assessment at this stage, again saying this is very early, it will take quite a while for this to be tabled again. Let's also recognize that the plan, which was that under the French EU Council presidency, this could be finalized, will be faced with pushback also from domestic stakeholders in France, etc. So this is by no means a given. I think the deal is quite in a precarious state at the moment. And in many ways, that's the state of affairs of EU-China relations also. In a precarious state because we haven't found a good balance of our relationship that is also accepted by the other side, if you wish. And I don't think the Chinese side has found a good way of dealing with the European Union either. So that's where we are, and certainly not a good outlook for the next few months.
Okay, perhaps we can conclude on the broader geopolitical question and the role of the United States. The United States and this incoming new administration, but also when it was an incoming administration, key senior officials did express, such as Jake Sullivan, did express some concerns about this deal and were suggesting that the EU should first talk with Washington before signing such a deal. Of course, many in Europe felt, why should we have to first talk with Washington when we do a deal with China? After all, Washington doesn't talk with us when we do a deal with China. So there was quite a bit of rejection against that notion. But nevertheless, I think there is now quite a lot of dynamism in the transatlantic discussion. The US foreign minister was in Brussels recently, and clearly the discussion was also about how to enlist the EU and how to work together with the EU to come to a reasonable stance, but also a critical stance vis-a-vis China. So where do you see sort of this trio going, and where do you see the EU in particular, given that it may well be squeezed in between these two major powers?
I mean, this is the million-dollar question, really, right? In many ways, I think we, from a philosophical perspective, if you wish, I mean, this is, what is our bet on the trajectory of China? Are we aligned in thinking about that going forward or not? I think that's at the heart of it in many ways. And I think the European bet, at least the German one, is still one that has a lot of optimism about elements of convergence, the future of innovation being written and as a chapter in China and with China. And I think the US assessment, obviously, is in some ways a different one. It recognizes these trends, but at the same time is much more worried about the structural dimension of that strategic conflict and the competition underpinning that. I think it's right to move on to some extent. Whether DG Trade has talked to Washington about this deal or not, I think they've tried, and the administration was just not ready to talk about it. That's something that we should recognize. But what matters most, I think, is what we do going forward. And on that, I think I have a pretty clear stance. I mean, what we care about is a principled China policy, and that's principled with regard to free market principles, liberalism, but also democracy and multilateralism in the way that we think it is appropriate for our interests and our values going forward. On that, I see a lot of potential for more collaboration with like-minded partners, much beyond the United States. And at the same time, I also think that Europeans are well served to clearly establish what our economic interests are, what our strategic interests are. And they are not, I mean, that's an easy thing to say, they're not to decouple from China. And that's an extremely tricky game. I think it's good to have renewed transatlantic dialogue on China policy now moving ahead. And the areas of disputes and where we will land in different camps are also quite clear already. Let's operate with what we have at the moment. And I think there's a good trajectory moving forward with like-minded China policy cooperation.
Great, Mikko. I think that's about the time we have for today. We could go on forever. And of course, the decoupling issue and, you know, what the world will look like if China and the United States increasingly decouple while Europe does not want to decouple is a very, very complicated game and very difficult, even from a purely economic perspective, a very different, difficult world. But we do not have time to discuss that in further depth. I want to thank you, Mikko, for joining us today on the podcast. And I want to thank all of our listeners for listening in and joining us for that conversation. Do visit our website, www.bruegel.org. We do have also on our website a paper that is going to be published on exactly the EU-China CAI deal written by André Sapir and Uri Dadouche, very much focusing on the economics of it. And you will find many other resources about EU-China and the Chinese economy at this stage. Thanks for joining, and until next time, bye-bye.